Welcome, everybody. My name's Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. It's Tuesday. It's 2:30, and that means it's time for the State Slate with Dan Shaver, Civic Media's very own political editor and creator extraordinaire of the Recombobulation Era. You can find the Recombobulation Era on Substack and subscribe there, and you can also find Dan's great work at civicmedia.us. Welcome back to the show, Dan. How are you?
I'm doing well, Maggie. Thanks so much for having me on.
You've been up since very early in the wee hours of today. You hosted one of our 6 a.m. shows. How'd it go, Dan?
Well, it was the show went really well, and I'm very happy with how it went. I'm not sure if you're hearing any audio issues on my end. I'm having a little bit over here. I apologize. But yeah, the show went really well. I am not a morning person, though, so getting up, setting the alarm for 4:30 to be into the studio by the 6 a.m. start time of the show, that was a little discombobulating for me.
A little discombobulating. I completely understand that, especially when you got to talk about some important political matters of the day. Let's just jump right in, Dan. What's top of mind for you this afternoon?
Well, for one, I just published a column at the Recombobulation Area. So I hosted the show this morning and published a column this afternoon. And the column is on the state Supreme Court race. It's on the state superintendent race. And I think this is going to be a more interesting race for state superintendent, more competitive race than we've seen for the office in quite some time. You know, this is part of the nonpartisan spring election cycle. And this is one of the races that doesn't get quite as much attention as the state's Supreme Court race. But part of that, I think, is because of the fact that we have that it has not been particularly competitive in quite some time. So we've Tony Evers, before he was governor, was the state superintendent. He won 2 elections in a row there with more than 60% of the vote. Jill Underlie, when it was an open seat in 2021, she won with about 57% of the vote. And I actually went back to see when the last time in Wisconsin this was decided by a single-digit margin, and it has not been since 1997 that this race was decided by a close margin like that. So going into this one, you know, Jill Underlie, you know, she got 38% in the primary. There's a couple different ways to see that. But Brittany Kinzer, she raised a ton of money as a late entry to this campaign. A lot of those funds came from your typical right-wing donors, Dick and Liz Uline, Diane Hendricks, a number of other names that you might be familiar with if you follow Republican politics in Wisconsin. And so because of that, and because of the increased turnout I think everyone is expecting in the spring election with the Wisconsin Supreme Court race, I think this could be the first race in a really long time that might be decided by a really close margin. And I think that is something to pay attention to here. As we, you know, I think that the headlines will be about Brad Schimmel, will be about Susan Crawford for the next 5 weeks. 5 weeks from today is when that election is
right around the corner. Wait, so what's the right's obsession? Like, why are they flocking to Brittany Kinzer? I know she's also been endorsed by every Moms for Liberty chapter in the state, Scarlett Johnson posting almost daily, one of the leaders of Moms for Liberty here locally. Why are they all gung-ho for Brittany Kinzer, who at least attempts nominally to appear to be very reasonable and nonpartisan? Is she really reasonable? Is she really nonpartisan? Why so much money from the right wing?
Yeah, I think it is. I think they see an opportunity. I think if anything else, they see an opportunity. She's been, you know, an education consultant, former executive at a charter school. And she was also the CEO and effectively a lobbyist for the pro-charter nonprofit City Forward Collective. And I think, you know, Republicans in Wisconsin have wanted to take on the kind of public education establishment in Wisconsin for a really long time. And I think they see an opening here. I think they see an opening with Kinzer and the ability to, you know, recognize the increased turnout that's going to come from the Wisconsin Supreme Court race.
Sure.
There are going to be a lot of Republicans heading to the polls to vote for Brad Schimmel. Stands to reason that if they're going to vote for Brad Schimmel, they might also cast a ballot for Brittany Kinzer. And that would make, you know, there's really never been, at least in recent history, a candidate like Brittany Kinzer who's posed a real threat to this organization. So I was talking to some education policy is not my forte, but talking to some people who are in the field, saying that, you know, this would be a really big shakeup if she were to advance forward in this general election.
Here's what's concerning to me. I don't know what Brittany Kinzer stands for, other than I was an education consultant and I advocated for school choice. What exactly is her platform other than I support school choice, which says nothing about the fact that we're looking at threats to IDEA funds, Title I funds, this dismantling of the Department of Education. Says nothing to the 90% of kids in this state and nationwide that get educated at public schools if they're concerned about outcomes. Says nothing about what's going to happen to my kid if they need an IEP at my local public school. Says nothing about the Republican proposal to strip away from you and me and everybody else the right to, by referendum, fund our local schools. Where does she stand on any issues other than being apparently the chosen candidate of the far right here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, well, I think it is going to play to some of those things that have been controversial for Underly in her time as state superintendent. I know there was, you know, even just last week, legislators in Madison, assembly representatives passed a bill changing kind of the testing benchmark standards that have been in question for as of late. So I think that's a more complicated issue than it lets on.
And I realize that Republicans are going to do all kinds of stuff related to school testing standards. My question is, what is Brittany Kinzer's stand? I mean, when you talk to anybody in public education, they're going to tell you, well, testing standards are only so good. For example, many teachers I know, both rural and urban districts, will tell you, if a kid comes in and I teach sixth grade and they come in at a second grade reading level, and when that child leaves my classroom and they're at a fourth grade reading level, that is a victory. But a lot of those testing standards don't grab that sort of information. So where does Kinzer stand? I'm like, hey, what is the best metric to determine whether a school system, an individual teacher, is succeeding? Where does she stand on, for example, tracking students and placing them into either special needs courses or in accelerated courses? Or does she stand with the establishment and saying that students should be mixed together? I'm so worried about this election, Dan, because it's like we're just voting on sort of vague notions of what these candidates stand for. And this woman hasn't run a school district of any size, let alone one of this magnitude across a state. So I'm worried. How do we find out what these two candidates stand for?
Well, for one, you know, we've had Jill Underly on the airwaves here at Civic Media, so you can go check out some of those interviews. Unfortunately, have not heard back from Brittany Kinzer's campaign about a potential. We'll keep asking though about what we might have an availability for there. But I think that's part of what's advantageous about her campaign is that, you know, when you're running as a challenger, when you're running against the incumbent, you know, you can just run on disagreeing with the incumbent. You can run on being the person who's going to bring change. And I think at a
undefined,
time right now,
unspecified, we have no idea what the change is. It's just something that's not the thing that exists now. I mean, I would like to think that Wisconsin voters are smarter than that when it comes to the future of their kids. That if you're going to vote for change, you damn well better know what the change that you're voting for is all about.
I think that's such a great point. But I think given the nature of this campaign, and I think the fact that, you know, Underly is being kind of put in this position to defend an establishment, a status quo that isn't necessarily working for people or mm-hmm. working for all people in the way that they might want to. And I think it's important just broadly, you know, zooming out beyond this race, for Democrats and those on the left to continue to be the voice for change, the voice for reform, instead of being kind of shoehorned into this uncomfortable position of defending a status quo that isn't necessarily working for people. I think that was a problem for Democrats last year in the presidential election and up and down the ballot. And I think it's a problem in these types of down ballot and, you know, ostensibly nonpartisan races as well.
One of the things that bugs me about that narrative here in the educational space was, first of all, it was Democrats coming out of the city of Milwaukee that really championed school choice, that created that, that got that going in the state of Wisconsin. Second of all, we need to be able to talk about what the legacy of vouchers and choice is in this country. It came about in the first instance as a reaction to Brown v. Board of Education. Vouchers and choice were created in the antebellum South to basically defund now forcibly integrated public schools and create basically all white private schools funded by taxpayer dollars. If this is new information for you out there listening to Dan and I, go check out the incredible work of Professor Catherine Eden, E-D-I-N, at Princeton. She's written extensively about that. Here's a quick quote. This was written by the White Citizens Council, okay, in its journal, The Citizen, in 1964, right after Brown v. Board. Dan, I thought you would, in particular, get a kick out of this because it certainly sounds like a campaign ad that Brittany Kinzer may be running. Again, this from the White Citizens Council in its journal, The Citizen, in 1964. It offered up step-by-step instructions for parents about how to get money from the state of Mississippi to send their kid to a private school. Here's the quote. Parents want their children to be raised and educated free from the tensions of racial conflict in the classroom, free from the frustrating drag of mass mediocrity, and free from the blight of self-styled progressive educators whose avowed aim is to turn young Americans from the established inheritance of their fathers to alien theories of collectivism and anti-white racism. Sounds like it could be an ad running today, doesn't it, Dan? Weird.
There are always echoes of the past in what's happening in the present.
Or a scream, like an out loud, outright holler coming from the far right of today. I wanted to also talk with you a little bit about a very, I'm going to call it an invented freak out by the right that just occurred, Dan. People talk about Trump derangement syndrome. I'm just going to call it MAGA derangement, full stop. Trans derangement syndrome. Dan, in brief, what was going on here coming out of the governor's budget address last week?
So this is really a strange one. And it is, you know, I don't know how much time we'll have to get in. I will have to get into this before the break. But basically, the right has started freaking out because they saw an item in Tony Evers' budget that changed the statute from saying the word woman to inseminated person. Now, yeah, on its face, and I went through this process too. I saw that and I was just like, that looks ridiculous. What is going on here? But then I actually read the bill. And my initial reaction was just something along the lines of, who's even asking for this? What is this trying to say? I read the bill and it's pretty much just clarifying language in a portion on artificial insemination that says if a lesbian couple has a baby by IVF, they're not both pregnant, but are both mothers. It also clears up some other things when it comes to fertility treatments and the like. They are not changing the definition of a woman to, say, inseminated person across the board. It is a completely ridiculous freak out that the right is having on this.
Yeah, just to try to make clear, two people can't be pregnant with the same child at once. That's not an actual thing, hence inseminated person. It's the right faux outrage machine. Version 3.52 sub BC Romanet 5. We're going to come back more on the State Slate with Dan Schaefer after these brief messages here on the Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep it locked.